Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Shri Bhagavan Uvacha.
Shri Bhagavan Uvacha.
Kautuhalaya.
Kautuhalaya.
Daityanam.
Daityanam.
Yoshid.
Yoshid.
Vesho.
Vesho.
Maya.
Maya.
Drita.
Drita.
Pashyata.
Pashyata.
Sura.
Sura.
Karayani.
Karayani.
Gate.
Gate.
Piyusha,
Piyusha,
Bhajane,
Bhajane,
Shri Bhagavan Uvacha,
Shri Bhagavan Uvacha,
Kautuhalaya Daityanam,
Kautuhalaya Daityanam,
Yoshid Vesho Maya Drita,
Yoshid Vesho Maya Drita,
Pashyata Sura Karyani,
Pashyata Sura Karyani,
Gathe Piyusha Bhajane,
Gathe Piyusha Bhajane,
Shri Bhagavan Uvacha,
Shri Bhagavan Uvacha,
Kautuhalaya Daityanam,
Kautuhalaya
Yoshid Vesho Maya Drita,
Yoshid Vesho Maya Drita,
Pashyata Sura Karyani,
Pashyata Sura Karyani,
Gate Piyusha Bhajane,
Gate Piyusha Bhajane,
Shri Bhagavan Uvacha,
Shri Bhagavan Uvacha,
Kautuhalaya Daityanam,
Kautuhalaya Daityanam,
Yoshid Vesho Maya Drita,
Yoshid Vesho Maya Drita,
Pashyata Sura Karyani,
Pashyata Sura Karyani,
Gate Piyusha Bhajane,
Gate Piyusha Bhajane.
Translation: The Supreme Personality of Godhead said, "When the demons took away the jug of nectar, I assumed the form of a beautiful woman to bewilder them by directly cheating them and thus to act in the interest of the demigods." Purport: When the Supreme Personality of Godhead assumed the form of a beautiful woman, Mohini Murti, the demons were certainly captivated, but the demigods present were not. In other words, those who maintain a demoniac mentality are bewildered by the beauty of a woman. But those who are advanced in Krishna consciousness, or even those on the platform of goodness, are not bewildered. The Supreme Personality of Godhead knew that because Lord Shiva is not an ordinary person, he cannot be bewildered even by the most beautiful woman. Cupid himself tried to invoke Lord Shiva's lusty desires in the presence of Parvati, but Lord Shiva was never agitated. Rather, the blazing fire from Lord Shiva's eyes turned Cupid to ashes. Therefore, Lord Vishnu had to think twice about what kind of beautiful form would bewilder even Lord Shiva. Consequently, he was smiling gravely. As stated in the previous verse, Prahasya Bhava Gambhir, a woman generally cannot induce demigods. They had made an agreement to work cooperatively for getting this nectar. And so then they churned the ocean. But as soon as the nectar appeared, then immediately the demons snatched it. That was their program. They'll go along nicely with it, but as soon as they can get a hold of whatever they want, then they'll take it. It does not matter for them, because they've made an agreement, they cooperate together. So these are all higher principles and that. But for the demons, giving up a higher principle for a lower principle, that is their standard. For a pious person, it's the opposite. They'll give up a lower position in pursuance of a higher. So this we see the difference in how the demons and the demigods work. So the demons, they're not worried that their word is not kept. You know, that they, as long as they get what they want. This is the demoniac mentality. Is that do whatever you must, you know, it's a practical thing. You know, the point is it's practical, is if you at the end of the day have the money and you are enjoying, then who's the fool? The other person who follows all these rules and regulations, the person who's truthful and honest, they're the fool, because at the end of the day, they're not enjoying. Because enjoyment is the purpose and goal in life. Therefore, you see, this is, you know, the present modern day position of how people perform their duties, and especially in business and economics. It's, you know, whatever works, then that's truth. That's the purpose. But what works for them is means what gets them their sense gratification. So for them, that is truth. So their truth then is on this platform of economics and sense gratification. This is the limit of their truthfulness. So because of this, and the demigods, they were doing, you know, their proper duties. They were behaving properly. So therefore then, Krishna thought, well, how to get this nectar back and how to cheat these people. They have cheated the demigods, so they don't deserve a portion of this nectar, because the demons are also part of the universal makeup, because it means the world is duality, so therefore you must have both. If you're going to have good, you must have bad. You know, if you have light, you must have dark. If you have, you know, hot, you must have cold. All these things. Then it creates properly this material world. So the demons are an inherent part of the world. So it would be natural that they would also take part in the drinking of the nectar. But because of their bad behavior, then we see them take part. They have cheated, so now they will be cheated. So then Krishna then cheated them, but on their platform. Since their platform is enjoyment, and they think the material world is perfect and wonderful to enjoy, therefore then he took the mood of Mohini Murti to bewilder them. Because for the demon, then sense gratification is the goal. Anything that you have must be for sense gratification. You get money, you get facility, then it must be used in this way. So they have this idea that this is actually how you'll get happy. So then for them also, then the, you know, the fine interactions between man and woman, this is also then the best of all their forms of enjoyment. So then they actually feel that there will be happiness and there will be satisfaction in the association between man and woman. Therefore, then this mood was taken by Krishna. And then in this mood, then they trust. That's the thing, is that what gives you what you want, you have trust in. You have, if you feel that this is what will make you happy, you trust that, because otherwise how you'll interact. To be happy, you must interact with something. You must interact with what it is that is valued by you. So there must be a trust. There must be a surrender. So then, naturally, since the form of a woman is very dear to the demons, therefore, then they surrender to that form. They surrender to, you know, they give themselves to that. Therefore, then, the Lord could very easily bewilder them by taking this mood. So we see here, though, that they are taking this mood, they have been bewildered, but the demigods have not been. Because of the being situated in goodness, then you see things in its proper light. You know, you see what the relationships are for. It means this Mohini Murti is not their woman, so therefore it is not for them to be bewildered. It means whoever is connected with the woman, that she is the bewilderment for that person, but not for others. So there is an understanding of these principles. And there's also just the point is that one can understand what it is that's there. It's the Lord's energy that is there. So that is what is the bewildering element. So those in the mode of goodness or those in Krishna consciousness, this is not for them a main pursuit. It is not a important element, really, in their life, is this being attached to the, you know, the finities of this material world. So then the material world is dealt with on the platform of duty, on the platform of what must be done, what should be done. You know, because if there's a situation, then something should be done. So then according to what should be done, that is what is done. So that what is done is then based on the authority of the scriptures, Guru, Sadhu, and Shastra. So then those in the mode of goodness, those who are transcendental, they accept this position accepting what is to be done. And the demons, their padati is what is good for sense gratification, that is what they follow. So if dharma is good, they'll follow it. But if they can get their sense gratification without dharma, then why they'll bother? Right? It means we work together, we get this nectar, great. But once the nectar is there, then if we can just take the nectar, then why we'll bother sharing? Why we'll bother? Because it was simply a means to their end. So since their end is lower, then they will use these religious principles as they please, when they like, for their own purposes, but not otherwise. So this makes the difference. But those who are actually, improved in their, mental position, mental condition, then they will use religious principles for upliftment. So for them, it's always how you say, the senses must be controlled. The senses must be kept in line so that one can appreciate the higher points of life. But the demons, so for them, it is their goal is upliftment, while the demons' goal is sense gratification. Therefore, the same principle will be used by both, but in two different directions. So the Bhagavatam then mentions to us that should be avoided. We should never use the religion for economic development, and whatever economic development we have should not be used for sense gratification. So this is the principle, that the religion should be used for spiritual upliftment, for gaining proper understanding, knowledge, and for situating ourselves at the lotus feet of the Lord. This is the actual purpose. So then, therefore, then the demigods, then they are not bewildered by such things, as we see in another pastime. Then this one great king, Mahabisha, he had performed so many great sacrifices and austerities and that, so he became elevated to the heavenly planets. And in the heavenly planets, then there was some program at Lord Brahma's place, and so all the demigods went to attend this program. And he also went along. So then everybody was situated and seated and all this, and then at that time then Ganga Devi, she came into the assembly, and somehow or another a breeze blew, and it blew her clothes, disheveled her clothes, and that revealed all the various aspects of her physical form. So all the demigods then, according to etiquette, just they turned their head or lowered their head or some way, because she was in a compromised position. So the natural thing is you don't take advantage of somebody who's in a compromised position. So then they turned their heads. But this Mahabisha, he was so bewildered by her beauty, he just stood staring at her. And so then she noted that, and Lord Brahma noted that, and so calling the two of them over, then he said that, this is not good here. This is not acceptable. It's that you're not supposed to behave in this way. So since you're behaving like an ordinary person, then you should return back to the earthly planet. And so then he asked him, if he would like, under which king would he like to take birth? So he said under this Maharaj Pratipa. And then he appeared as Maharaj Shantanu. And then Ganga Devi, she also then came and then appeared and became his wife. And then from this, then Bhishma Dev was born. So we see is that amongst the demigods, then this is not becoming attracted to or bewildered by the form of a woman. It's not prominent element in their life. It is not the driving force behind their endeavors. But we see on this planet or amongst the demoniac, then this is most important for them. You always hear of the demons moving around, and whenever they find, some girl, it doesn't even matter what species of life, if it attracts their attention, then take her back to their place. So in this way, sometimes they have, I think Ravana had 10,000 wives like this. And they were all from different species of life, so they were, it wasn't that they were overly particular. As long as they were, you know, good looking, then that was enough. So then, so this being the case, and Shiva being Mahadeva, you know, the greatest of the demigods, then how he'll be bewildered, because Cupid once came, tried to agitate him. He shot his cane, he shot his arrows, but it didn't work. And then Shiva, glancing at him, burnt him up into ashes. And so then, you know, Cupid after that was a lot more careful about trying to deal with Lord Shiva. After that, he didn't bother him. So then Krishna has to, you know, think very, very seriously about what form of a woman would bewilder Lord Shiva. Because Shiva is all, his wife being Parvati, then all the expansions of feminine beauty and feminine manifestation within this world are all coming from her. I mean, she's expanded, you know, to have her more pious forms and that, and then so therefore you get reflection of that in all the pious women, and then she had all her not as pious or not as pleasant forms as Kali and Chandi and all these others, you know, running around either half naked or completely naked and with their, you know, sword in her hand and lopping off heads and drinking the blood and throwing heads around, you know, having a good game of footy with all the heads and, you know, stuff like this. And then till finally she has the one where she cuts off her own head and that, and then all her friends are drinking the blood and she's running around with her own head in her hand and, you know, like this. So they have many, you know, pleasant forms that are there that, you know, generally that the, how you say, mentalities that the ladies know about but the men choose to not know about or don't know about. So there's nothing in this world, any form or manifestation, female manifestation, that would bewilder Lord Shiva, because his wife has all these manifestations. And so if he's not bewildered by the complete form of that, he definitely won't be bewildered by a partial form of that. So then Vishnu has to think very seriously, then what form can he manifest that will be a bewilderment to him? Any questions on this?
Someone was asking me just
a little louder.
Sorry, I'll speak up. Someone was asking me yesterday, Maharaj, that about the thuggy cult, which was based on Kali. How legitimate was that? Legitimate or not?
Well, when you get into the there's different forms of worship. The Vedic culture is geared that it, I mean specifically the thuggies themselves. It would be an upper sampradaya of this Kali worship. You know, just for that point. So it wouldn't be what the scriptures are recommending. So what it is some people then thinking about it who are worshipping in this way then come up with some idea. So therefore then they take it in this way. You know? So that is a problem. I think it was also political. It wasn't just purely religious. It was political. So therefore those persons who were opposed to certain things or in favor of certain things. I don't know the details, but there are books on their history and their purposes. But basically is that the Vedic culture, the idea is everybody, no matter what their consciousness, can somehow or another be engaged in the essential principles of Vedic culture. You know, which are meaning, control of the senses, respect of authority, following the scriptures, you know, and trying to develop a service attitude, because the nature of the soul is service. So you're trying to reawaken that, and then that means you need then the respect for authority, guru, you know, the parampara, the shastras, the regulation, all that must be done. So that is, you know, the principles on which the whole, you know, spiritual culture and spiritual science are founded. But not necessarily, nor not very many, are actually interested in the pure spiritual understanding. Therefore, the Vedas present something for everybody. So at least that point is in place. If those points are in place, then if you do come in contact with the pure spiritual culture, it's very easy for you to follow. Because it is your lifestyle, it is how you, your values. So then it doesn't matter which position they are, what how much they're into, you know, either upliftment or degradation or sense gratification, whatever it is, the dharma, artha, kama, or moksha, whichever they're into, then there's something for them to keep them fixed in these principles. Then at least it's progressive, it's uplifting. Though it may be slowly progressive, it may be millions of lifetimes before they come to the next stage, you know, from you know, how you say, very low level, stages of worship up into, you know, higher grade into the mode of goodness. They take into ignorance, then passion, then goodness, then within goodness from the karmakanda, fruit of work, they get into jnana, and then from there into yoga. So like this, you're talking probably millions, billions of lifetimes to go through this by this method. But at least it's progressive. That's the idea. A little progress is better than, you know, regression. So then, therefore then, for those who cannot, who don't value the higher principles, then you have to work these in to somehow or another what will be attractive to them. So people who are interested, you know, seriously in sinful activities, therefore you create a system to regulate those sinful activities by certain ritual and all that, and that you need a guru for, you need to approach shastras for, because of regulation means the senses will be controlled, but because you're dealing in a field of their interest, therefore they're motivated to take part, you know. It's just like you take an example on the higher level would be in the mode of goodness is that we should understand that whatever we require will come. Krishna has already provided that, you know, and according to our present condition state is based on a previous condition state. So whatever good is to come of that previous condition will come to this condition state. So one can work on that principle. And if one can, then that's nice. Then you can spend your time basically engaged in studying and teaching and preaching like this. You don't have to work so much for the economic development. But if one doesn't, you know, one is not comfortable with that, one feels the need to, that by my work it should create economic development, then work must be there. You know, those who can understand it's coming from previous life, they're also working, but not for economic development. They're performing their duties to study and teach. But someone who feels, then there's a process. Okay, so if you're going to do that, then these are the processes by which you will endeavor for economic development, and then receiving the rewards of that, then how you will engage those properly in a pious way. Does that make some sense? So, in other words, it just keeps going down, down, down until it gets more and more kind of, you know, ignorant.
Can I just ask another question? I've heard that, is tantric in the mode of ignorance, is it true?
Tantra means ritual, basically. So even what we follow is also tantra, but it's sattvika tantra. So the pancharatrik is sattvic tantra, where the tantra is focused simply on Lord Vishnu. So therefore the ritual is there. So it's technically, by definition, it's tantra, but it's not referred to in that way. We're referred to as the pancharatrik system, like that. So it's a form of upasana, but it's ekayana, means it's only focused on the Supreme Lord. While others then, in the mode of passion, then they will worship all the demigods because they want their material benefits. And then in the mode of ignorance, then they have even more, it's not necessarily uplifting desires they want, sinful desires that they're interested in. So they follow a process to, you know, so-called fulfill those desires. You know, but they have to do all kinds of funny things, you know, sit on dead bodies and do their meditation and, you know, stuff like that. And, you know, do their pujas and that at the places, you know, at the graveyards and, you know, all this kind of tamasic and dirty stuff, you know. It's very gross. So it appeals to the mind, the gross mind. You know, it's just like, let's say, medicine. It means you do have medicine that it's pleasant. But sometimes if it's pleasant, there's kind of a feeling that maybe it won't work. Well, if it tastes bad or it's very difficult, then we feel that the result will be better, you know, because it was more, you know, the work was harder, it was more rough, so therefore we'll get a better result. So in the same way as when you get down into the mode of ignorance, therefore then the worships and all that are very, very rough. So we see even sometimes I think Vitrasura, then he was doing his worship and offering parts of his body into the fire, and finally Shiva's not appearing, so he decides to offer his head. You know, so it's a little, you know, so it matches that. I mean, just nice worship of Shiva, he will be pleased, you know. He doesn't need all this tamasic thing, but the demons, they feel that this will get results. You know, if I just sit there and offer him a few flowers, what I'll get. But if I offer my head, then, you know, now we're talking serious, you know. Because it would take great determination to offer your own head into the fire. So if you had that, but they can only do that in a tamasic way. Well, someone who's purified, they can have that same determination in the mode of goodness. So therefore, even though they're only offering a flower, then, but they have that same determination. Therefore, it pleases the Lord. You know? So, because that's, therefore you get, it just matches the consciousness of these people. You know, something rough and tough and, you know, I mean, it's like you can make yourself attractive by, you know, just being clean and neat, you know, and dressing, you know, in a proper way, you know, how you walk, how you hold yourself. But it's more subtle, but, you know, but some they find, you know, by dressing in a rough way, walking in a rough way, talking in a rough way, or, you know, tattoos, or, you know, other things, you know, you poke things through your nose, your ears, or things like this, that makes them beautiful. You know, so it's a rough and gross way, you know, so, but for rough and gross people, it's attractive. Like that. So, therefore, and it's more pain, it's more difficult, it's more, you know, kind of, you're dealing in a lower tamasic way, so it's rougher on the mind, it's more painful, and they feel they're getting some benefit from that. While to, you know, live in a more simple sattvic way, they would feel wouldn't give proper results. Does that make sense?
Yes, so you mentioned tattoos. Tattoos a Vedic thing, or is it just in this lower mode?
Tattoos, see, means they'll use tattoos, but generally what they use is this stuff called mehendi. It's a herb of a plant, and you put it on, you make all kinds of decorations, amazing decorations, on the hands, on the feet, like that. And so then, depending on how long you leave it on after you put it on, it'll last from a few days to up to a month, like that. So that's generally what they'll use for tattoos. They don't use this thing of poking, because in Ayurveda, to poke through the skin disturbs the life airs. You know, so therefore then it's not so good. So that's, you know, you have to be, you know, pretty tough to go through tattoos, you know.
One other comment, Rajab, you're saying about a general demoniac mentality regarding marriage and women. It's funny, I heard a comment by a man who knew Elvis Presley in the box, and he said that they asked him about getting married and having children, and Elvis said, "Why should I keep a cow when I can get milk through the fence?" Elvis is me.
Yeah. That's because it's exploitation. Like that. But that's basically how the world works. It's just a matter of how obvious or how subtle you want the exploitation to look. That's all. Means if you have, see, it's in the spiritual world, there's no exploitation, because God is the enjoyer and the living entity is the enjoyed. So he is doing his activity and the living entities are doing theirs, so it matches perfectly. So there's no exploitation. But in the material world, when you have two people who are the enjoyer, then that means your enjoyment comes through the other person. So basically what it means is that there is a agreement for mutual exploitation. Like that. So you appreciate how they allow you to exploit their senses, and you don't mind how they exploit yours, so therefore it's a match. That's actually the situation. So then if you just take that further, then they're not interested in the pious coverings of that. Because rasa means they're only interested in the sensual rasa, which means sense and the sense object. So the sense you have and the sense object is what the other person has. So then, therefore, you know, on that platform, then what is the need? There's no need of marriage, this, that. Like you see animals, there's no marriage in this and that. But when you get up into, if you want to deal with emotions, then you must get into these things. Then you require the whole institution of marriage. You know, and what that means. You know, the protection, the security, the children, the whole, the interrelations in the family, all those interactions. Then that becomes the essential thing. And sense gratification, the senses are just part of that. You know, you have, mother has relationship with the child, so that's a rasa. So included in that rasa, the mother will take care of the senses of the child. She'll feed the child, bathe the child, do all these things. Those just come as secondary. They're not primary. The primary is the relationship between the mother and the child. And secondary, the senses are included. It's just the higher includes the lower anyway. But when it becomes degraded, then that part is not there. It's what you get out of the child. You know, it's that the child comes to me, the child, you know, does this and that. So as long as they're doing that, the mother's very happy to be a mother. And when the child's not doing that, then they're very frustrated and upset and, you know, may deal roughly with the child or, you know, because the child will only be like that part of the time. So, you know, a little time in the morning, a little time in the evening is fine, and you spend the rest of the day out at work, and then someone else can look after the brat. You know, like that. So then, you know, you get your sense gratification, but you get whatever you want also. You know, you get your money, you get your time out, you can wear your miniskirt, you know, your kid, your three-year-old couldn't care less about your miniskirt. You know, so you can go out and do all these things that please yourself, and the kid is just one of your pleasures. So that's exploitive. There, you see, therefore, in the modern society, that you know, the institution of, you know, parenthood is not strongly in praise. Therefore, the children aren't satisfied, the parents aren't satisfied, no one's satisfied, and you end up with weird kids. You know, and these weird kids grow up and become the next generation of weirder parents, and their kids then become weirder kids, like that. So it just slowly goes down. But when the focus is on the parental rasa, then you don't have the thing of miniskirts and going out and doing your thing. You know, I'm an individual, I have to have my time. No, because parental ras means your time is the time with the kid. That is, if your value is that rasa, then you have to have it when you're with the child. Therefore, in the Vedic culture, because rasa means the rasa on the platform of emotion was more important than the rasa on the platform of the senses. Therefore, you see, then the women would stay in the house with the children all day. And in the modern, because it's on the platform of the senses, therefore, then the women spend their time out on the street. You know, and just whenever it suits them, then they're with the child.
Right, it seems like in the modern society they actually have propaganda that says to women that, look, you're not going to be satisfied just doing this. There's no way, you know. So then, even though they may have some leanings towards being maternal, they lose all that in the pursuit of some cheap promise.
Yeah, that's because the cheap promise means they're out on the street, so that means people can exploit them. You know, the girl is thinking she's. It means it goes both ways. She is getting the happiness of controlling. She puts on something, you know, very scanty and walks down the street, and everybody on the street looks at her. You know, so it's a control, and they enjoy that. So therefore, they're getting what they want out of it. And then the men are getting what they want. They like to look at beautiful women. So instead of having to buy a magazine or, you know, have keep one in the house, you can just go out on the street and there's plenty of them to look at, you know. Or you go down to the beach, you get even more to look at, you know. So it's just, you know, it's fine for them. Women think they're being independent and doing what they want, and it's just exactly what the men would like. You know, it just saves them the trouble of having to take them out to dinner and, you know, all that thing to see that much. They can just see it right walking down the street. So it makes life a lot easier for the materialistic man. But because it comes in that I'm doing it, then it encourages the controlling and enjoying propensity in the woman, so she feels satisfied that I'm doing what I want. But it's just, she's just making herself open for more exploitation. If you understand rasa, then that is it's there. So that's why Prabhupada said it's foolish. You know, he said, yes, your freedom is to, you know, move with anyone you like, and when you get pregnant, then you can either, your choice is to kill the baby or to live off the government. Yes, that's your freedom. You know, so it's not understood what's going on. You have to, if you understand the rasa that's going on there, then you understand what is actually going on. So that's why the demigods, and they don't get so bewildered, because they understand. So they understand the womanly nature, the manly nature, and they know how and when to put it together. So just because a woman is beautiful or even a woman is naked doesn't mean it's your business to take advantage of it. You know, why, Ganga Devi, she ends up practically naked, but it's not a plan, it just happens. So therefore, in that compromised position, she shouldn't be exploited. Therefore, you don't look, you know. You know, she wasn't planning like that. And even if she was, if she's an apsara and out there dancing, you know, half-dressed, then, you know, she's doing it as a service. And so then that's reciprocated by those devas who are interested in such things. You know, and they take part and appreciate the dance. But it's the exploitation, it doesn't become gross. You know, it's subtle. So it's a different thing. So therefore you don't have to. So if one understands what is satisfying, means, because women don't know themselves, therefore they can be bewildered by such campaign like that. But if they understand who they are, then they'll understand it doesn't necessarily work like that. And it's just, it doesn't happen. Does that make some sense? Yeah.
Talking about upper sampradayas and Lord Shiva, you know, the Nagababas and how they smear ashes and they smoke ganja. Mm. Is there a particular pastime of Lord Shiva that, is there a form of Lord Shiva that smokes ganja? Was there a particular pastime that took place in once, or what was this?
I'm not sure exactly, but
I first read in the
but book. I think when you get down to the, like the Kala Bhairava and those kind of the low end of the manifestations of Shiva, you know, then I think those, then they deal in that area like that. Because for them it's the ganja is for focus, meditation. Because when that, everything goes and it's just the mind. So if it's trained, then they focus it in one way, like this. You know, and then they forget all the other things. I mean, the interesting thing is they use it, so they forget about women and this and that. They just get into whatever, because their habit is their pujas and their other things and whatever they're doing, their chants and their sadhanas. So everything else will go and they'll just focus on that. So it's interesting that in the, you know, non-Vedic, then they use it just the opposite. They use it for, they smoke dope and have sex and all these things. So It's a very different approach, though it's still tamasic, you know.
Prabhupada mentions in the Gita how they imitate Lord Shiva.
Yeah.
There must have been a form of Lord Shiva that engages in that.
Yeah, yeah. I think it's there. But I can't say specifically, I don't know, like that. But it wouldn't be Sadashiva, and it wouldn't even be, you know, Shiva with Parvati. This would be down when you get into these really heavy, you know, dark, black, you know, forms. You know, like when you have Kali, there's also matches of Shiva. So when she gets wild, she's running around, she wears a skirt of arms, she's going naked, you know, she has a sword, her hair is loose, and she's just, you know, anything that comes in front of her, the head is separated from the body. You know, it doesn't matter who it is. So even when she sees Shiva, she goes to cut off his head, but then she realizes it's her husband. So then she stops.
What about the Rudras?
The Rudras, they're, I'm not, The 11 Rudras, they seem to their business as destruction. So they
are they forms of Lord Shiva?
Yeah, they seem to be expansions of Lord Shiva.
They look like him.
Yeah.
They engage in the dance.
Yeah. That seems to be their business. So until there's destruction, they're on holiday. And when destruction is there, they're... So they had... Brahma had said, expand, as a Prajapati, expand the universe. And so then, when they did, then they started to get all kinds of people who would just destroy the universe. So then Brahma thought, well, maybe we should stop this one. So he dropped that. So it mentions all their names, all the 11 Rudras and that. And so they come to all the different functions, and they're major, players in the universal... like social hierarchy, the 11 Rudras, 12 Adityas, like this, the Saptarishis, and they're. But I can't say so much about them.
What are Adityas doing?
Adityas, those are the 12. How do you say? 12 devas who for 1 month take the role of doing the duties of the sun god. So in a zodiac sign, when it changes zodiac signs, that's when it's changing the Aditya that's there. So then Vivasvan is, considered the main, but he's only one of 12. Varuna is also an Aditya. Vamanadeva is an Aditya. That's explained in the 12th canto. It'll explain who sits on the seat for which month and who's all their associates. Because sun god, he sits in the chariot, then there's somebody else they push the chariot, certain demons push, and apsaras are there dancing, and the priest is there, different rishis are there, all these different things. There's a singer there, Gandharva is there as the singer. And so for 1 month, and they do those duties, and then the next month it changes, and someone else does. Like that. So that's their business. Yes.
This is another point that you mentioned early on in the class about performing duty.
Uh-huh.
And I had a situation a couple of years ago where my mother had bowel cancer. And at that time, I wanted to go to Kartik. So I went.
Mm-hmm.
And she had her operation whilst I was there. And at the time, I think the situation got quite serious. And I was contacted in Vrindavan. Sorry, I'm a bit nervous. I was contacted in Vrindavan, and I was told by, I had conflicting stories, I was told by my husband, who was not there at the time, that I had to come back to Perth to be with my mum. And whilst I was there, I was told I had to work in snow, we were in Vrindavan, it's county, stay here. So, what should I have done at that stage? What was my duty at that stage? I had already said, that's Maya, don't go back to Perth, your mother's, it's Maya, family is Maya. And also had a situation here where I know of some other Matajis that have problems, conflicts with family life versus temple service. So can you please explain how we should see it as devotees, how we should apply?
So these... The application of this is very much according to the need of the person involved, like that. So it's like, let's say you were saying some Matajis in Vrindavan were saying it's Maya to go back. So did those Matajis have families?
It was actually
Prabhus. Oh, okay, Prabhus. Okay, then that's another thing. But now were those Prabhus married?
Yes.
So then, then what is the value of... They're saying it's Maya. They're in Maya, and they're telling you that you shouldn't be in Maya. Right? So it doesn't match. The instruction doesn't match. If they were not married, they didn't have the need for marriage and emotional interchange, with a woman. Then they could say, point out how it's Maya. That your mother is not really your mother, the real mother is Krishna, and like this, so therefore since you're serving Krishna, then these lower duties are not there. are important, if you can then function on that platform. But if you're functioning on the platform where you have a family, you're going to interact, so therefore then family means relatives, means the whole thing, then you have to interact in a way that is, consistent with that platform. You know, that's kind of the modern thing is you pick and choose, or the sinful, like what Krishna explains, Prabhupada explains in the Gita, is capricious activities, is choosing only what you want from your duties. I like this duty. Okay, you know, it's like, you know, we like to go over and be with mom because, you know, then she'll write us in the will. You know, but if she's not, she doesn't have a cracker, then who cares? So that kind of stuff is not, you know, it's like if you're going to be a mother and have a child, then you have to take care of all the needs of the child, not just what you want, when you want, how you want. You know, or if you want to have a husband, then you have to take care of the needs of that husband. If, like, the husband has a wife, he has to take care of the needs of the wife. So then you have to look at what level you want to function at. If you want to go back to Godhead this lifetime, or you want to, you know, let it slide for a few lifetimes, then you have to see what's there. So then if you're serious about going back to Godhead, then you can't have then you have to put what is good for spiritual advancement as primary, and then work your, you know, emotional and economic and sensual needs around that. Or if Krishna consciousness is important but secondary, then you have to work that around your, you know, emotional and social and needs. So then, in this kind of a case, is that one, it means one could do both. It's not that one has but it's that you could do both. You could do one then the other. So it's not that it would be specifically Maya, like that. So since the mother, it depends also on the mother. If the mother is saying that, you know, no, don't worry, you know, others are here, they'll take care. And, you know, this is an important thing that you go at this time to Kartik. You know, you will, maybe you, there's, you know, for some reason or another, there's no other time. And for you and your position in life, that would be very valuable due to maybe, you know, just some situation in your consciousness at the time. So such a situation would be actually good, and she feels also good, then that would be the best. But if she's really feeling that, you know, as a mother, she expects you to be there and all those things, then one would consider that might be more, you know, socially proper. It is Maya, but it's a Maya that you have to adjust with. If one's not interested in Maya, then number one on the list is interaction between man and woman. So it means no marriage, no nothing. And if one can take that position, yes, then one doesn't have to worry about that. You know, if you're willing to put on white, shave up today and not have anything to do with men ever again, then yes, you could avoid these things with your mother.
Is it possible for one to want to be at a festival, an ISKCON festival, and that mentality be an illusion, thinking that, well, that's where I want to be, you know, it's fun being with the devotees, and that not actually perform one's duty, which is to be at home with, to look after your husband or to look after your parent or your child or whatever it may be, and use that as an excuse of, I just want to get away from the situation because I want to be there and be at the festival or whatever.
It means
seems to be the conflict that I think I've overcome that myself, that at times when I meet up certain devotees where they're actually going through an immense amount of turmoil in their lives, where they think that they actually have to sever their ties with family or sever their duties at home because they feel they need to come to the temple and make a garland or whatever it is. And the advice that I've been giving to them, and I don't know whether it's proper advice, is that you can actually do your service for Krishna at home, you don't necessarily have to be physically on the temple premises. And that's basically my concern, that we think that it stops at the gate.
Yeah, it means it's one has to be able to. Krishna conscious means you have to be Krishna conscious wherever you are. But at the same time, there's a fine balance between placating one's own desires and therefore interpreting the philosophy to suit that, and what is actual practical for your position. So it's a very fine line. Someone has to be, that's why it said those who are thoroughly honest, then they can understand the Bhagavatam, because then they'll look at it accordingly. It means that it's like if one takes the, putting the family as second, then better, and will ignore, but at the same time one wants to be there when one wants. Then that's another thing. Okay, so the wife wants to be at the temple to make the garland and not be there for, let's say, the morning before the kids go to school and everything like that. That's fine, as long as in the evening when the husband wants to be out at the temple, then she's happy to sit at home alone. But generally, you have to just check, is she out on her own when she wants to be and then complaining that the kids aren't there, when the weekend's there and they could be home, but they prefer to be out with their friends, and who cares for their mom? The husband would rather be out with his friends. And then she's saying, what is this? We're a family. Why no one's here? Then it's inconsistent. So it's if she's out making the garland and the other family members are happy with that, and then they're out doing whatever they want when they want, and she's fine with that, then you could adjust with that. You could have such a family situation. But if we find that there's emotional needs that are expected, because that's marriage means that. You expect something from someone else. It's not, we're not dealing with gopis and Krishna here, We're dealing with husbands and wives think husbands are going to do this, and husbands think wives are going to do that. So you have to know what the other person expects and and if you agree to it, then you have to try to fulfill it, Otherwise, know what the other person expects of you. And if you can adjust with that, then you marry that person. And if you can't, don't marry that person. Find someone else who you can adjust that. What they expect from you, you can do. So then you have to see what it is. So if you have a family that doesn't have such emotional needs, and just so now and again they're together, they know they're there in case something serious is there, but otherwise in day to day they're happy to each do their own thing, then it's nice, it's less encumbering. But if it's not, then you have to see what it is, because that's the point, is that's the duty. If one gets married, that means you have duties, so therefore get married to someone who has the same nature. That's why in the Vedic culture, seeing that the nature is the same, is similar or is compatible, is the most important element. Otherwise you have someone, let's say, who's very sattvic and wants to be at the temple all the time, their attachments are very minimal, but some emotional need is there. Therefore that's why their interest is there in marriage. Then you have someone else who's very attached and always likes to be will put their own attachments over other duties is more important, then those two shouldn't get married, even though they may be attracted by each other's physical beauty or some other aspect that has nothing to do with it, because at the end of the day you're talking to the subtle body, you're living with the subtle body, not the gross body. The gross body will do what the subtle body wants, so it doesn't matter how beautiful the girl is or how beautiful the boy is. Is if the subtle body is not nice, you're not going to be happy. It's like, you don't hear is that, big fight with the spouse yesterday and all that. But I don't mind because they're so beautiful, so I don't care that they were yelling and screaming and throwing this and that and cursing at me and beating me and that. But that's okay because they're so beautiful. They look so beautiful when they give that, roundhouse punch. It's just like that. And the guy says, it's just her feminineness comes out, when she, tosses that china plate across the living room. You don't hear that. It's they're disturbed. So it doesn't matter how beautiful the body is. That's not the consideration. So therefore, you have to see the subtle bodies, because that's actually what you're marrying. Because the subtle body has the need. The body is dead matter. So depending upon what the subtle body needs, therefore it engages the gross body. So therefore, you have the basic principles, but application is very subtle. It's not black and white. Is that you have to see the family situation. So if they are able to do that, they are able to, then it's nice, you know, because then the association and all that, sitting at home may not have the same association and same potency as sitting in the temple. But, like you pointed out, is this idea that the temple is Krishna conscious and home is complete Maya, that's also a weakness. Because one has to be able to bring the temple life and temple atmosphere to the home. You know, though it's a compromise. Grihastha life means compromise. That's just the way it is. If that's understood and accepted, then people could actually deal with the grihastha life probably in a more balanced way. So they could understand more where they have to spend more time at the home and where they can spend less time. They don't have to be there. You know, like that. One has to see what is actually quality time. Is it for our own pleasure, or are we connecting that to Krishna? So it's a big science. But generally because of not acknowledging that, then you get the extremes. Temple life is Krishna conscious, and outside temple life is Maya. So then that will then create within those who live outside the temple then to be Krishna conscious, and they have to be at the temple. And at home they can't be Krishna conscious. Or they'll create their own philosophy that, you know, what's the problem? You know, we're being realistic, and the people in the temple they're actually in Maya. They're not honest. You know, we're honest. We know we're nonsense, so therefore we're being natural. And they are nonsense, but they're not acknowledging it. They're the ones in illusion. So therefore then that's what Gita says is religion, the mode of ignorance. They can't tell the difference. Religion becomes irreligion, and irreligion becomes religion. You know. So the point is, why don't they be honest and just acknowledge that this? It's not the best path. Is this better, touching your nose like this, or is this better? Right? You'd have to be a fool to say this is better. You'd have to be so self-confident and so blind to say it is better. It is not good. So therefore, Prabhupada says, not getting married is first class and getting married is second class. It's just obvious. Because if you want to just chant Hare Krishna and go back to Godhead, then why would you want to encumber yourself with so many things that are going to distract? But if you can't avoid that because the mind goes to that and requires that because of our conditioning, then the second class path is the best path for us. You know? But it's the path is second class. That's just understood. You know? But it's not that one can't get great benefit out of that path, because the path itself then detaches us from the path. Proper application of the path of marriage detaches us from marriage, you know, in a complete way, not in a superficial way. You know that, okay, this marriage didn't work, and then we go on to another marriage. That didn't work, go on to another marriage. You know, like that. But it by engaging in grihastha life in the proper way, it removes the need and desire for it. Like that. So that becomes the position. So it's very delicate. You have to see each individual and apply it. You know. It means we understand that service in the temple and all, these are ideal. But at the same time, you can't compromise the family unless the family doesn't require. If the family is also very, very sattvic, that they don't require so much input, then as long as whatever little input they require is there, then the balance time you have. But if yourself and your family require, you know, great amounts of quality time, then that has to be spent. But at the same time, as one should understand that is not the ideal. So then even that should be slowly tried to move towards, you know, being less detached, though you're looking at possibly, you know, 20-30 years to do that. You know, does that make some sense? Okay. Yes.
Why didn't Vishnu just show Mahini form towards Shiva without trying to bewilder him? Because what Shiva asked, I wish you see that form. He didn't ask for the bewilderment.
That's what I asked yesterday.
Okay, let us say you go down to the beach and you want to just check out what's the, you know, latest fashions on the beach. So can you honestly say that you are doing that just for a, you know, scientific analysis of, you know, the various, you know, pieces of cloth and the shape of the cloth and, you know, however it is that whatever, you know, standards are there amongst the, you know, modern, contemporary women, you know, of their qualifications compared to, you know, previous, you know, times you've been to the beach. But bewilderment is not at all part of, you know, your purpose. Can you say that?
I can equal these two.
The point is that Shiva wants to see Mohini because she was the most beautiful. No one had ever seen such a beautiful form of the woman. So he, as Purusha, is interested to see. He is Shakti, he's an energy of Krishna, but at the same time he's a Purusha, he's a bona fide Purusha. He is male, he's not female. You know? Means your Vishnu Tattva and Shiva Tattva is male. All Shakti Tattva is female, no matter what form, it's internal, external, or what manifestations, you know, Sambhit, Vladini, Sandini, it's all female. But he's male, so he'd like to see just what is this form? You know, it's like means his wife is the original form, he's seen Radharani, but he's said to see what does Vishnu look like when he takes the form of a woman is interesting. So he's not specifically interested in the bewilderment, but at the same time is one looks at the form of a woman expecting to find it to be beautiful. Right? So that it's beautiful means bewilderment. Right? Means, you know what I'm saying? Means the form of the woman... Yeah, but the form of the woman on its own is not beautiful. The women work very hard to be beautiful. Both in their attitude and in just how they dress and makeup and, you know, perfumes and all that. They have to work hard. Means you find body of a dead woman, it's not beautiful. You know, or a woman when she's in a bad mood is not beautiful. Like that. So they have to work at it to be beautiful. So he was interested to see the beauty. He had heard she's beautiful. It wasn't just he had heard it was a woman. She wants to know, what is that beauty? What is that form you showed them? Because you bewildered the demons. So he's not thinking he'll be bewildered because he is not bewildered by his own wife, so let alone any other form of a woman. So it's for fun that then Vishnu is doing this because they're close friends. They're very intimate friends, you know, like that. That is the position here, you know. They're basically non-different. Though at the same time, even though they're non-different, just like Krishna and Balaram are non-different, still Balaram cannot fully understand Krishna when he wants. So same, Shiva is non-different from Vishnu, at the same time as he doesn't understand what Vishnu can do. So it's for some fun. Like that. That's why this smile is there. You know, it's just, you know, good, clean fun. Like that. Is that okay?
That's only acceptable.
Yeah, but I just say, I mean, why do you do tricks on your friends? Do you do tricks on friends, on people you don't know? You do tricks on friends who are intimate. And the idea is from it, it will increase the rasa, increase the intimacy. You know, you don't do it as a maliciousness or envy. You do it to as some fun to increase the rasa between you. So therefore, because Shiva is so dear to Krishna, therefore he's having some fun. Is that okay?
Yeah.
Yeah. I get you.
Maharaj, you speak of the relationship between a man and a woman is a science that should be applied. And I think I read a quote from Prabhupada somewhere that he said that if in the presence of father, husband, or elder sons, a woman has to earn a livelihood, and that is a great insult. Yet we see that in this modern society, the economy is structured in such a way that a husband and wife find it very difficult to economically have enough funds to raise a family and do all those things that they have to do. Unless both of them are working, it's the whole capitalist idea was here. Well, there's the whole section of the population that we haven't exploited yet, so let's get them all working and everything like that. And that's basically what's happened now. So how do we, in these modern times, how do we apply those principles?
It depends upon your need. So if, see, is now how do they get you out working? How do they get the women out working? Because there's so many things that the women need to buy, and the house requires, you know, otherwise you'll die. So therefore, you know, like a washing machine. You'll die without a washing machine, right? Means there's you know, 1 billion people in India who wash their, you know, hands, you know, clothes by hand, but they're dead though breathing, you know, like that. You know, you're mixy, you have to have a mixy, you know, you have to have your bread making machine, you have to have this, you have to have that, you have to have so many gizmos, you have to have, you know, unlimited kind of stuff, you have to be wearing the latest fashion, even though you just bought your, you know, $1,300, you know, whatever it is, you know, Gucci dress, you know, tomorrow you have to have another one. So, you know, and your shoes, right? You can't just have a few. You have to have at least, you know, 20, 30, 50, 100 pairs of shoes, you know, well, it's a little more than one for every day of the week, but at least one for every day of the year, you know. So then all these things, then you have to work hard for. But if you work hard, so the woman goes out and works, and because she works, she has very little time. Therefore, the washing machine has to do it. Therefore, the bread machine has to do it. Therefore, you go out and buy clothes rather than make the clothes. You know, and someone else has to take care of your child because you're out working. So all those, you have to pay the money. So if you didn't pay the money and you were at home, there would be no loss. You understand? I mean, what does it take for buying rice, dal, and sabji? And if you really want to know how to make money, look at the Indians. They come to the West, they're rich. They own their own houses, have their own cars, have land back in India. And the Westerners, they're, renting and all these different things and have nothing. Because the Indians, they go to a place, get a simple place, dress simply, eat simply, and save their money. And they are rich. So they don't buy into the modern concept of the social interaction that you have to have all these things or you're a deadbeat. You know? So they know it gets by anyway. Because the relationship between husband and wife, so they like each other. She doesn't have to be in the latest fancy this and, you know, all this, you know, whatever it is, you know, $90 a tube, you know, hydration for the last 3 hours on their wrinkles, you know. So, you know, he accepts her for what she is. So she doesn't have to play around with 1 hour putting on her face, you know, and that face also costs plenty of bucks. You know, so much money is saved just because they're honest about accepting each other for who they are and they just live a simple lifestyle. So then so much money is saved. You can take, great, I mean, why is it? They come here, they take over. There's no poor Indians here. You go to America, there's no poor Indians. You go anywhere, there's no poor Indians. And they went there with nothing, and they started off with nothing, and then with time, then they had plenty of money.
They work hard.
Yeah, they work hard. They work hard, but their women don't go out and work. Like that. So that's the point, is that by how they live and by their, you know, endeavor and their intelligence. We're just talking on this. We're not talking about how, you know, their aptitude and ability in this. That's a whole nother thing. So then it's just there because they don't buy into the Western lifestyle. They'll buy in later once they're rich, but when they're not rich, then they don't. So if one's simple, one can get by. But it's just according to one conditioning what is going on. You know, it's like a kitchen in India has no electricity in it. And they can produce things that it would be hard to find a Western woman who could even get near to cooking those things. And the variety, and that goes on their whole life. They can just cook. There's not one electrical thing in their kitchen. Right? And but they survive. But in the modern kitchen, you know, everything is electric, everything's this, that, otherwise it's not. And then you find good cooks, they can use all that. But you take all that away, would they be able to do it? Because they can't put in the time. You know, cooking means this much time bus, and then the rest of the time you have to be doing whatever, you know, valuable thing that's important to you. But here, then they, you know, okay, cooking means 3 hours, 5 hours. With the quality of it, the energy that goes into it, the result that is there in the consciousness on the other family members, you can't compare. You know, you can't compare the consciousness of, you know, the bread and the bread machine. Of course, you know, with, I'm sure with great affection, the mother, you know, turned the machine on. You know, like that, you know. And, you know, and, you know, it was great affection that she made sure there was some, you know, butter in the fridge so that the kid could put, you know, butter on his toast, you know, when he has to make it up himself because she's already at work. You know, but still those, you know, how you say, how much time does it take? You know, it means you think about the butter and pick it up and put it in the shopping cart for, you know, maybe a second, and, you know, flipping the switch and putting the few ingredients in, you know, may take 30 seconds or a minute. So, you know, One minute and 1 second doesn't compare to 5 hours or 3 hours or even 1 hour. So therefore, the interaction between the family members and the depth of relationship also you can't compare. So that is also your choice. Do you want shallow relationships, money and shallow relationships, or do you want deep relationships and less money? Unless you're clever, and then you'll get money anyway. Like that. Is that?
It's interesting. It's a matter of values.
Yeah, that's the whole point. Is what do you value? If you value your women and you value the family, then the man will work hard and he'll use his intelligence and get the money. And the woman, because she values the endeavor of the husband, therefore whatever he brings, she's satisfied with. Main problem is if women, the root of this is the satisfaction of women. The women aren't satisfied with what the husband provides, then they'll have to go get it themselves. But if they're satisfied, then it doesn't matter. You see, in, you know, all over the world, there's people living, you know, under a tarpaulin, you know. But there's a whole family scene. You see it. I've seen it myself in Calcutta. You know, there's always the thing, you know, your mother tells you, you know, don't waste food because they're starving in India. They're not starving in India. Bangladesh, maybe, but not in India. You know, you're walking down the street in the evening time, and there's all these people with little plastic sheets on the road and a you know, an old tire on the top to keep it from blowing away. And they're out there on the street. They got their pot. The woman's there grinding the spices, all these things like this. And they cook probably a better meal than a Westerner eats, as far as taste and the endeavor and, you know, the desire to please and all that. And then they sit together as a family. You know, they don't have much. They have one you know, aluminum plate to eat out of. But oh, the whole family's sitting there. You know, so it's right on the sidewalk, but they have a family. They have nothing, but they have a family. So it's their values. Well, in the West, they have money, all facilities, but there's no family. You know, now you call it a family. I mean, in modern usage, it's called a family. But as far as reality, it's not a family. You know, it's just, it's not. Very shallow. So that's the point. It's values, you know, is there. And duty is there. It always brings success. If the values are good and the duties are performed, success is always there, you know, according to your karma. So some are small, some are rich. So you see, Indian, they have money. They're not poor. Some have a lot of money, some have a little, but they have enough whatever, for whatever their position. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Something else? Yes.
You mentioned about interpreting philosophy according to our own desire. What role does the spiritual master play in protecting a disciple from doing that?
is helping us understand the mood in which we should approach it. That's the thing. That's the means. They're not going to solve your material problems. That's up to other family members and those who deal in that field, the community and all that. But they can give you the tools by which you can approach it. What's the proper way to view it? You know, what is the proper balance? And then from there, then you have to make your decision. But the idea that he's going to work it out, everything, you know. The guru is the surrogate father, husband, manager of your life, everything like that. That's not exactly what the Vedic concept is for. But what is there is to give you the keys and the tools on how to make those decisions. Because you have to make them yourself. Like that is how to approach. What is the balance according to my nature? So then what would be a proper approach? So that is what we gain. In the spiritual matter, what is the ultimate goal? What's the process to get to that? And in that, since our conditioned nature is there, how to deal with the conditioned nature to properly engage in Krishna's service? This is a voluntary thing, so he can give the directions, but you have to make the decision. But it's that he should make the decision on, you know, whether you should buy this house or not, or that car or not, or whether you should get this job or not, or, you know, whether you, you know, get married to this one or that one. No, he can tell you what are the principles on which you decide who you're going to marry. You have to decide what you look for in the job, what you look for in these things, according to your nature. Well, you have to make the decision. Is that okay? Yeah, okay. We should say this should be last.
I have a question in two parts. Number one is, when Mohanimurti appeared, it seemed that demigods didn't get bewildered.
Yeah, they didn't.
Because they could see that's not there.
Yeah, or it's just not their woman, so therefore it's not their business to be bewildered. But the demons think all women are their women, so therefore they have the right to be bewildered by any woman.
Yeah, so they didn't get bewildered. Unlike Lord Shiva, when he saw, he got bewildered. So I want to explain. I'd like to have explanation between them.
Oh, how he could get bewildered and the demigods wouldn't. Okay. Because the mood that he manifest was a mood that would bewilder Shiva. If he wanted to bewilder the demigods, he could have. You know? Means it's just like you see the apsaras when they're just behaving, just performing their normal duties, they don't bewilder the demigods. But when they want to bewilder them, or the demigods want to be bewildered, they can do that. They know how to dance and move and sing and look to bewilder them, but they don't. See, a woman bewildering a man is planned. But it's organized as such that the man doesn't understand that. This is also a great science. You know? The man thinks it's out of his own natural, manliness that he's attracted. No, the woman has arranged that. It's been orchestrated. You know? Like that. So it's also a big science.
The other part is, you also mentioned the demigods, they are well behaved in the matter of their women and others' women. But we see in the Puranas and histories that demigods are quite aggressive towards, or they're quite rebel the principles of ethics and morality towards others' women.
You don't have those ethics up there in morality. In the heavenly planets, because they're not. See, ethics and morality is what creates the fruit. If you're ethical, it creates a pious, good fruit. You're unethical, it creates a bad fruit. So they're only living out the fruit of their of what they've already done here. So for them, it's not unethical. You understand? It's a different scene up there. On the heavenly planets, the women aren't connected to the men. Means they are, but at the same time, they're free. So if they're if they're interested, children, then their husband is there. Otherwise, not. Just like Rumba Devi, she's one of the five top apsaras, but she's married to I think Nalakuvara Manigriva, one of the two. That's her husband. But it doesn't mean she doesn't go out and dance and do all these things. And when Indra sends her for some black operatives to catch one of the sages or something like that, then she goes and does. That's her job. So it's a different scene up there. It's a whole different scene because they're just trying to enjoy. But it's within goodness. What's her name? Urvasi, tell Puru Ravas, you show up one time in front of me naked and I'm gone. Because naked form is not pleasant. It's not nice. A naked form of a man or naked form of a woman is actually ugly. That's why you see, is if a woman wants to be attractive, they only show parts of their body. They don't show the whole body. Show the whole body, they're ugly. They only show part of it, then it's attractive. Same with a man. Naked man is very ugly. But if you just show part of it, then it's not so ugly. So therefore, it's in goodness. They're performing. It's a different realm. It's to engage those who are sattvic and inclined towards morality, but are interested in sense gratification. Plus, sometimes they have a bad day. Okay, in the last 150 trillion years, okay, then I think it's, I'm not sure, yeah, the moon god made off with Brihaspati's wife once. That's not a bad record. once in 151 trillion years. Okay, we can live with that. So therefore, you don't find many instances. Indra with Gotama's wife. A few like that. Very few. It's a handful. But you're not dealing with sin there. They can reduce their pious credit, but they can't create sin. They're just not in that place. Just like, can you create sin by killing people on a battlefield? No. But if you're not on the battlefield, it's sin. So therefore, it's a completely different realm. That's the whole point. Is you can't apply earthly morality to the demigods, because it's a different situation. That's all. And because they're there to enjoy and we want to go back to Godhead, therefore their example is not for us. If you want to go to the heavenly planets, okay. But you can't get there by doing what they're doing. You have to do something else to get it. Right? Like you're on a vacation. But how do you get on a vacation? By being on a vacation? No, by working hard. Right? Then you can go on a vacation. But when you're on a vacation, you don't work. So because you don't work, are you considered a lazy bum? Do people look down on you that this guy's, not working? The wife's not cooking? The kids aren't going to school? This is sinful, right? No, it's a holiday. It's a completely different thing. So therefore, it's a different application. That's why we only take certain aspects of it that are important for helping us and understand the culture and the science of Krishna consciousness, and the rest we leave. We're not interested. That's for them. They're interested. They take part. Is that okay? Okay. So we'll end here. Gruntaraj Srimad Bhagavatam ki, Srila Prabhupada ki, Samaveta Bhaktivinoda ki, Jainitai Gaura Premanandi.